We're going to talk about the spinal muscular atrophy chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Absolutely. A critical resource.
So our goal today is really to dive in and pull out the highest yield points on SMA, focusing on what sophisticated learners really need to know clinically and biologically.
Sounds good. It's a complex topic, but fascinating.
Okay, let's jump right in then. What exactly is SMA? At its core, what's happening physiologically?
Well, fundamentally, SMA is a disease characterized by progressive muscle wasting and weakness.
Right.
And the root cause is the deterioration and loss of specific nerve cells, the alpha motor neurons.
The ones in the spinal cord?
Precisely. In the anterior horn of the spinal cord. And this loss leads to that pattern of weakness, typically moving proximal to distal, so closer to the trunk first, then outwards.
Got it. And we know it's genetic autosomal recessive.
Right.
But talk about the genes involved. There's SMN1, but also SMN2, right? How does that work?
Right. That's really the crucial part for understanding the variability. The primary cause is a mutation or deletion in the SMN1 gene, the survival motor neuron gene located on chromosome 5.
Okay, the main player.
Yes. But then there's this very similar gene, SMN2. It's like a less effective backup.
Less effective how?
It mostly produces a shortened, unstable version of the SMN protein. Only about 10 to 20% of the protein it makes is fully functional.
I see.
But here's the key thing. People have different numbers of SMN2 copies, maybe 2, maybe up to 8. And the number of copies you have largely dictates how severe the disease is. More copies mean more functional protein, generally leading to a milder form.
Wow, so that copy number is almost like a dial controlling the severity. How does that manifest in the different types, like type 1?
Exactly. Type 1, which you might have heard called Wernicke-Hoffmann disease, is the most severe form. The onset is typically right at birth or within the first few months.
The floppy baby syndrome.
That's the one. Very low muscle tone. A really key clinical sign here is the absence of deep tendon reflexes, the DTRs. They're just gone.
And the prognosis.
Historically, very poor. The progression is rapid, and sadly, respiratory failure often leads to death within the first 2 years of life without intervention.
That's devastating. Okay, what about type 2? If a child makes it past infancy.
Type 2 presents a bit later, usually between 6 and 18 months. The progression is generally slower than type 1.
Are they ambulatory?
Typically, no. These children usually achieve sitting but not walking. They also have those absent DTRs. And orthopedically, type 2 is where we see major issues emerge.
Like scoliosis?
Yes, almost universally. They tend to develop scoliosis, often a long, flexible neuromuscular curve, and contractures, hip dislocations, those are very common challenges as well.
We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com. Don't rely on us. Read the book.
A really important resource for diving deeper.
So clinically, you see maybe a floppy infant or a child who isn't meeting motor milestones, absent DTRs. How do you confirm it's SMA and not something else, like, say, muscular dystrophy?
Diagnosis is actually quite definitive now with genetic testing. DNA analysis confirms the mutation or deletion in the SMN1 gene.
Okay.
Imaging, like X-rays, will show the scoliosis if it's developed that long, sweeping curve, maybe pelvic obliquity, hip issues.
I'm distinguishing it from MD.
The classic differentiator, the one clinicians always look for, is the DTRs. Absent in SMA. But in most forms of muscular dystrophy, the DTRs are actually maintained, at least early on. That's a key distinction.
Right, that makes sense. Now, the treatment landscape has just, well, exploded recently, hasn't it?
It's been truly revolutionary. We now have disease-modifying therapies, nusinersen, for example.
How's that one work?
It's given via intrathecal injection into the spinal fluid. It targets the SMN2 gene, the backup one. It basically modifies how the RNA from SMN2 is spliced, tricking it into producing more of the full-length functional SMN protein. It boosts the output from that backup gene.
That's incredible. And then there's gene therapy.
Yes. Onasemnogene abeparvovec, brand name Zolgensma. This is actual gene replacement therapy.
Wow.
It uses a harmless virus, an adenovirus vector delivered intravenously to carry a functional copy of the SMN1 gene into the motor neurons. It's approved for young children under 2 years old. These treatments have fundamentally changed outcomes.
Amazing progress. Let's shift to surgery. For those type 2 patients with scoliosis, what's the approach?
Managing the scoliosis is critical, largely for protecting lung function. Bracing can sometimes slow progression, but it usually doesn't stop it in these neuromuscular curves.
So surgery is often needed.
Often, yes. For younger children with significant curves over 50 degrees, we might use growing rod systems to allow continued spinal growth while controlling the curve. Then, usually in adolescence, or if the curve hits 40 or 50 degrees and lung function is a concern, definitive spinal fusion is the standard.
And you mentioned something unique about surgery related to the new treatments.
Ah, yes. Because nusinersen requires repeated intrathecal injections, sometimes surgeons will perform a limited laminectomy, removing a small piece of bone at a single lumbar level.
Just to make injections easier.
Exactly. It creates a clear, safe window for future access to administer the medication throughout the patient's life. It's a fascinating example of surgery adapting to pharmacology.
It really is. What about the hips? You mentioned dislocations are common.
Yes, and managing them can be controversial. If a hip dislocation isn't causing pain or functional problems in a non-ambulatory patient, often the decision is to observe it.
Really? Not reduce it?
Well, the recurrence rate after surgical reduction is quite high in these patients. So unless it's symptomatic, observation is frequently preferred, focusing on comfort and positioning rather than perfect anatomy. Soft tissue contractures are also often managed non-operatively.
That makes sense. Prioritizing function and comfort. Okay, let's wrap up by hitting five key takeaways from our discussion. First, spinal muscular atrophy. Think progressive weakness, floppy baby syndrome.
Second, the location. Alpha motor neurons in the anterior horn of the spinal cord. That's where the damage occurs.
Third, the key gene. SMN1, survival motor neuron gene. Its loss causes SMA, and it's the target for gene therapy.
Fourth, remember the historical name for the severe form, type 1, Werdnig-Hoffmann disease. Important to recognize the types.
And fifth, a game-changing treatment, nusinersen, targeting that SMN2 backup gene.
Absolutely. And, you know, the success of these early treatments raises such interesting long-term questions. What will the orthopedic needs, the neurological outcomes be for these children in 30, 40 years, children who now have a vastly different future? It's something we'll be learning for decades.
A really profound thought to end on.
We've just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia, by Bernstein and Ian Byatt. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.